Tonight on PBS News Weekend, a region on edge. Israel is on high alert tonight as the nation awaits an attack from Iran. Then, after Arizona's high court revives a near total abortion ban, how Republicans are navigating the political fallout. And with the world's top golfers competing at the Masters tournament this weekend, a look back at the first African American to play on the PGA Tour.
It was a rough life, but he was strong and determined. And, you know, he wasn't going to let anybody stop him from doing what he wanted to do.
Good evening, I'm John Yang. Tonight, Iran's much-anticipated attack on Israel is unfolding, slowly. Israeli Army spokesman Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari says dozens of drones have been launched from Iran and were most recently seen over northeastern Iraq. Officials say the drones won't arrive in Israel for several hours. Israel's been on high alert for days. Military defenses have been beefed up. Israeli airspace is now closed. And officials closed schools for tomorrow, the beginning of the Israeli school week. In Washington, President Biden cut short a weekend at his Delaware Beach home. He returned to the White House to meet with national security officials. U.S. and Israeli intelligence have been warning for days that Iran was preparing an attack. They say it was in retaliation for a suspected Israeli strike on an Iranian diplomatic building in Syria, which killed senior Iranian generals. Against this backdrop, Iranian special forces seized a cargo ship indirectly owned by an Israeli-born billionaire. Iran said it was taking the ship to their territorial waters. A Mideast defense official shared cell phone video appearing to show commandos rappelling from a helicopter. The ship's operator says it has a crew of 25. It happened in the Strait of Hormuz, which connects the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman. On Friday, the ship had been seen off the coast of Dubai. Israel says it's an act of piracy and has called for sanctions. And tensions were high on the West Bank. The Israeli army found the body of a missing 14-year-old Israeli boy who the military said was the victim of a terrorist attack. It was his disappearance that sent Israeli settlers rampaging through Palestinian villages yesterday, setting homes on fire, killing a Palestinian man, and wounding more than two dozen others. The unrest continued today, and Israel has sent more troops to the area. In Australia, a lone attacker stabbed six people to death at a popular Sydney shopping center. Eight others were injured, some critically. They included a nine-month-old baby who required surgery. Police shot the attacker dead. It triggered chaos among the shoppers. Hundreds fled and sought shelter outside. Eyewitnesses say the attacker appeared to target people indiscriminately.
All I heard was put it down, and then she shot him, but we were not eventually. She didn't shoot him. Well, he would have kept going. He was on the rampage. He was on the bloody rampage.
Authorities say it was an isolated incident not related to terrorism. In southeastern Ukraine, more than a dozen people have died as Russian troops escalate their assaults across the east. Russia says Ukrainian shelling has killed at least 10 people, some of them children, in Russian-occupied territory near Zaporizhia. Ukraine says Russian attacks killed at least three civilians elsewhere in the country. And in the mountains of southern Turkey, all 174 people stranded in dangling cable cars for nearly a day have been rescued. The ordeal began Friday when a cable car struck a pole and burst open, sending the passengers to the rocks below, killing one of them and injuring seven. It happened just outside the resort city of Antalya during a busy Eid holiday week. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, the story of Charlie Sifford, the first golfer to break the PGA's color barrier, and a brief but spectacular take on the miracle of flight.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
The near total abortion ban that the Arizona Supreme Court revived this week dates back to when Arizona wasn't a state yet, when slavery was legal, and when only white men had the vote. Many Republican officeholders and candidates scrambled to distance themselves from the law. It underscores some of the political consequences of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to strike down the constitutional right to seek an abortion and leave it up to the states to decide whether to regulate it. Barrett Marson is a Republican strategist based in Arizona. And before we get going, Mr. Marson, I think we should make clear to the viewers you're not working for any candidates on the ballot this fall.
No, I am not. And thanks a lot for having me on, John.
Thanks. In Arizona, it's a swing state in the presidential election. You got a toss-up Senate race, and you got a couple of congressional contests that are going to be very close. How is this, what happened this week, this Supreme Court decision, going to affect those races?
Well, I think, you know, you said it all in that sentence there, except for that was what was last week. This week now, I don't know if the Senate race is a toss-up anymore. I don't know. You know, I think last week we were a lean Trump state, and I think this week we're a lean Biden state. I think Carrie Lake is on the wrong end of this issue. And in fact, you know, I think a lot of Republicans who have, quite frankly, championed this kind of thing for, what, two generations, are finding themselves, at least in Arizona, on the wrong side of how voters feel about this issue.
Have the Democrats picked up on this? Are they pressing this?
I mean, that is what they are doing 24/7. And rightly so. I mean, look, right now, you know, again, a week ago, I would have said the border and immigration and the economy and inflation were absolutely not only the top two issues, but they were very much Republican issues. And now I think abortion is the number one and prevailing issue. It is the issue that will take the oxygen out of the room for any other issue. So you will see abortion be front and center in every time Democrats open their mouths on the campaign stump. And Republicans right now just don't have an answer for that.
You mentioned Carrie Lake. She's running for the Senate this time. 2 years ago, when she was running for governor, she called this law a great law. And you also mentioned other candidates and office holders who have been championing this law or this idea and now have to deal with it. How should they deal with it? How can they deal with it?
Well, look, it's been dogma in the Republican Party for, you know, again, two generations, three generations. So I think, frankly, just own it. You know, talk about why you are pro-life. Talk about the benefits. Talk about the need maybe for more of a social safety net, but talk about the benefits of being pro-life, because there is no really running away. And there, you know, otherwise, just like Carrie Lake, you look like a massive flip-flopper. And, you know, 2 years ago, she called this the model for other states. And now she's talking about she's pro-choice. So, you know, I think you should just, a Republican candidate should just own this. They've been wanting to do this for a couple of generations. They've done it, celebrate it, and embrace it.
To that point, and you also mentioned this has been Republican dogma, they got it. They got what they wanted when Roe was overturned. Is this sort of like the dog that caught the car? They don't know what to do with it now?
Well, it's certainly in Arizona, where the electorate is at least willing to have some sort of legal abortion, whether it is we will have a an initiative on the ballot most likely, and that would allow abortion up to 24 weeks. And I think that will pass maybe now with 60%+ of the vote, especially if it is a choice between zero abortions and maybe something a little bit too far to the left, but better something that's legal than nothing.
Florida, of course, finds itself in a similar situation. Their Supreme Court cleared the way for a 6-week ban to take effect at the beginning of May. They've got, or likely to have, a constitutional ballot initiative on their ballot as well. Is it going to have the same effect there, or do you think it's different?
Well, you know, Florida is has been trending Republican for sure. But again, this ballot initiative has the chance, both in Arizona and Florida, to bring out so many young people, so many first-time voters. And we don't know whether they will stick around, you know, come out for the abortion initiative, but stick around for Joe Biden and Ruben Gallego and, you know, and Senate candidates and House candidates down the ballot. Certainly, they're going to come out for the abortion initiative, and it'll be up to the Democratic candidates up and down the ballot to convince them to stick around and vote for them as well.
Republican strategist Barrett Marson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
On this weekend of the Masters Golf Tournament, a look at the man Tiger Woods has called the Jackie Robinson of our sport. Charlie Sifford was the first black player to get a PGA card, qualifying him for the professional golf tour. It came in 1961, a full decade after the color barrier had fallen in professional football, baseball, and basketball.
Charlie Sifford cut a distinctive figure on the fairways. That cigar jam between his teeth was more than just a trademark. He said it helped him with his swing and putting. For most of his professional career, he played not on the PGA Tour, but on the UGA, the United Golfers Association. Black players called it the Chitlin Tour, formed for those not welcome in the all-white PGA. In 1961, the PGA finally dropped its Caucasian-only bylaw, which had been in place since 1934. Prompted by a chance meeting with Sifford, the California Attorney General had threatened to sue the group. Sifford was 42, his prime playing days behind him. Still, he went on to win two PGA tournaments, the 1967 Greater Hartford Open and the 1969 Los Angeles Open. In 2006, his achievements in golf were recognized with an honorary doctorate from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, home to what's considered to be the world's oldest golf course. Just months before Sifford died in 2015 at the age of 92, President Barack Obama awarded him the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian award.
On the tour, Charlie was sometimes banned from clubhouse restaurants. Folks threatened him, shouted slurs from the gallery, kicked his ball into the rough. Charlie's laughing about that. My ball's always in the rough. And because golf can be a solitary sport, Charlie didn't have teammates to lean on. But he did have his lovely wife, Rose, and he had plenty of guts and grit and that trademark cigar. And Charlie won on the tour twice, both after the age of 45. But it was never just about the wins. As Charlie says, I wasn't just trying to do this for me, I was trying to do it for the world.
Sifford played in 12 U.S. Opens, 6 PGA championships, and was the first black player inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame. But he never played at the Masters, which he once called the most redneck tournament in the country. Sports writer Peter May has written a new book about Sifford and the California Attorney General who pressed the PGA to act. It's called Changing the Course, How Charlie Sifford and Stanley Mosk Integrated the PGA. And Charles Sifford Jr. is Charlie Sifford's elder son. Mr. Sifford, I'd like to start with you. Your father, of course, is a legend in golf, but he was also your father. He was your dad. What are your memories of him as a man and as your dad?
You know, my father was gone a lot playing golf, but I knew why he wasn't at home. You know, he was doing what he loved to do, and that was play golf. That was his dream. That's the thing that, you know, he wanted to do ever since he was 11 years old.
And when he was home, did he talk about the frustrations and what he was going through trying to get into the PGA?
When he first started, all he wanted, you know, it was just a game. He wanted to be able to play his best and play against the best, but he wasn't allowed to do that. You know, he had death threats and a lot of other things going on. And people called him and told him not to come to the golf course. He called him names. It just showed me, you know, he was a special person. You know, because everybody just couldn't have played as good a golf as they did and be under that kind of pressure.
And, Peter, in the book, you detail some of that, some of the hardships that he went through, but also, despite those hardships, the performance on the course.
Yeah, I mean, he would go to tournaments and he'd be forced to change clothes in the parking lot, eat in the parking lot. There were things that were thrown in his way virtually every tournament he played in, south of the Mason-Dixon line. And Charles is right about that. It had to take a certain type of individual to be able to put up with it, but not to overreact. And he was that guy. He was the perfect guy for that moment. He got death threats, as he said. He was called the N-word. That's what he had to go through.
I remember you talking about the writing about the Greensboro Open one year,
right,
where he got a lot of heckling from the galleries.
Mm-hmm.
But he still shot a really good round.
Yes, he did. The Greater Greensboro Open was the first, really the first tournament south of the Mason-Dixon line that a black player played in. And he played extremely well the first day. He got a death threat call at the house he was staying at the second day, and he finally had to move. He ended up, I think, tied for sixth or fifth. It was as good a performance, I think, as he could have ever delivered, given all the other stuff that was going on.
And Mr. Siffer, you say he didn't talk about that at home. Do you get the sense he was trying to shield you, trying to protect you from that?
Yes, he did. I've heard him talking to my mom, and that's how I found out about a lot of the things. He never really talked to me one-on-one about what happened. Every now and then I was able to, you know, get a hold of a newspaper and read different things. It was a rough life, but he was strong and determined. And, you know, he wasn't going to let anybody stop him from doing what he wanted to do.
Peter, I was surprised to read in the book that it was actually in the PGA bylaws,
right,
that it was for golfers of the Caucasian race. How did it get ended?
It got ended thanks to the other partner in this story, Stanley Mosk, the Attorney General of California. He heard about it from Charlie. He was introduced to Charlie at a country club in Los Angeles by Billy Eckstine, the great singer and band leader who championed Charlie's cause for a number of years. When Charlie Sifford told Stanley Mosk about this, Stanley Mosk was incredulous, and he didn't know anything about golf. He didn't know anything about Charlie Sifford other than that he was a golfer, but he went to work. And it took him about a year and a half to 2 years to finally, you know, beat the PGA over the head enough times that they figured out that they better change it.
Threatened him with lawsuits.
Threatened him with lawsuits. Threatened to stop the tournaments in California from happening. So, yeah, he was a big part of all this.
And, Mr. Siffert, of all the honors that your father got, one of them was the first black man inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame. Peter describes that induction ceremony in the book. It sounds like an incredibly emotional event. What do you remember from that night?
The first thing I remember is my wife and I, we stayed up for about a week writing and rewriting his speech. And we had it done in big print, because he was having trouble with his eyes at that time. But when he got up on stage, he was so emotional that his eyes started watering, and he couldn't see the pages of the speech, so he just started talking, you know, from his heart. I think the biggest laugh he got was when he was telling everybody that when he got the phone call, he made sure he was going to get there to the hall for the induction. He slowed down in his driving, and he was careful crossing the streets because he didn't want to take a chance of missing the opportunity to go into the Hall of Fame.
One thing you do note in the book is that after Charlie Sifford broke down this barrier, there was not an influx of black golfers into the PGA. Today, I think there are only probably about four black professional golfers. Correct. Why do you think that is?
It's still a white player's game. It's a country club game. That's where all the golfers go to get lessons and play on good courses. And it's not a game that has really embraced blacks as much as they should. There hasn't been the movement that Charlie and Tiger both hoped would happen. It hasn't happened.
Mr. Sifford, you were an amateur golfer. Are you frustrated by that there aren't more in the game?
Yes, I'm sure, and my father would be too if he was still alive. One of the main reasons, you know, is this an expensive sport. You had to buy clubs, you had to pay to go play the game. A lot of the blacks that got into the game back in the time when my father was playing started off caddying, so they were able to learn the game by watching other people play. With the invention of the cart, that eliminated the caddy positions for the most part, so that eliminated the exposure that the young blacks have to play the game. It's starting to get a little bit better, with HBCU schools having some strong golf teams, and tournaments are starting to develop where they can play in and get exposure, and they're getting good instructions now, which they never had when they were, you know, back in the day.
Mr. Shepard, obviously your father has this great legacy as the man who broke the color barrier. As his son, as other members of your family, your children, his grandchildren, what would you hope that his legacy would be?
That they remember him being a strong-willed individual who set a goal and worked to achieve that goal, you know, and did it in the right way. You know, he was a pioneer. He didn't consider himself a civil rights leader, because, you know, he just He didn't think of himself that way. He was just trying to make it easier for the people coming up behind him to be able to have a better opportunity to play the game.
Charles Sifford Jr., Peter May, thank you both very much.
My pleasure.
My pleasure.
Derek Fennell is an entrepreneur, an author, and for more than 14 years, a flight attendant. Many of his passengers know Derek for his in-flight poems reflecting on his time in the skies. Tonight, Derek shares one of his poems and his brief but spectacular take on the miracle of flight.
I've been a flight attendant for 14 years. We're all used to the flight attendant. Make sure that you have all your bags underneath the chair in front of you. Make sure your seatbelt is buckled. Make sure your seat back is upright. How many times have you heard a poem at 36,000 feet? Today again we fly. We enjoy the energy of the people at the port, the hustle and bustle and excitement of going without thought, moving from city to city amongst the skies, observing the beauty of nature as we fly. People from all around the world we meet, sharing unique and interesting conversations as we speak. Seeing their smiles again without a mask, you begin to realize just how much COVID-19 has put us all through a task. Today again we fly. Clear to close and ready to go, we shout as we bring the world together without a doubt. Up, up and away we go as the mighty jet engines begin to roar. Today again we fly. Cruising at 36,000 feet in our office with wings and special guests such as you can't be beat. Yeah, that's right. 36,000 feet where the air is thin. And only for those who can handle the heat, today again we fly. I usually say this poem as we're making our final descent. The enjoyment that I get from the humanity of sharing that poem with everyone is when they break out into an applause. It's just an amazing feeling just to find that people really appreciate it that much. If all I do is serve you a drink, you had a really good flight, because what I'm trained for, you don't want to see. My name is Derek Fennell, and this is my brief but spectacular take on the miracle of flight.
Now on the PBS NewsHour YouTube channel, the latest episode of PBS News Weekly. Ali Rogan covers the biggest political stories of the week, including President Biden's plans to eliminate more student loan debt and Arizona's abortion ban. All that and more is on the PBS NewsHour YouTube channel. And that is PBS News Weekend for this Saturday. On Sunday, we'll have the very latest on the Iranian attack on Israel. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow.